Money is flowing into the country. In fact, when you look just under the surface at some of the most infamous white-collar crimes in the world, Enron, the subprime collapse, even the Trump-Russia investigation, it's not hard to find the Canadian connection. So what gives? In this season of Commons, we'll be looking at stories at the intersection of money, influence, and politics in Canada. Some of them will have to do with these big corporate crimes, and others will be the type of corruption we're more used to hearing about. Shady politicians, backroom deals, hush money, and kickbacks. But to start, I want to take you on a tour to help us better understand why white-collar criminals almost never have to face up to any consequences in this country. If you rob a bank branch, you're probably going to get caught and go to prison. But in Canada, if you rob the whole bank, even if you're caught, you're probably walking away fine. When most people in Canada talk about crime-ridden neighborhoods, they're usually talking about places where poor people live. The downtown east side in Vancouver, Regent Park in Toronto, the north end of Halifax. When I think of criminal neighborhoods, I really do think of Toronto's financial district. So that's where we're headed today. From Canada Land, this is Commons. This episode of Commons is supported by Endy. Endy is changing the way Canadians sleep, and their mission is simple: to provide Canadians from coast to coast with the best possible sleep. Endy's headquartered right here in Canada, and its signature product, the Endy mattress, is 100% Canadian made, which means they can cut down on duties, currency exchange, and international shipping costs to bring you the best mattress at the fairest possible price. Now, I got an Endy in the mail just recently, and it really is a good mattress. It's a great mattress. But what I really want to talk about today is the pillows. Those are some of the best pillows I have ever had. Like, they're really fantastic. I never thought that pillows could be so firm and yet soft at the same time. Endy's quality is second to none, and its pricing is even better. With a smaller price tag than its competitors, their mattresses cost between $675 and $950 Canadian dollars. That means even the largest mattress, a California King, costs less than $1,000. You simply can't find that kind of quality-to-price ratio anywhere else. So go to endy.ca and use the promo code COMMONS for $50 off any Endy mattress. Again, that's endy.ca, promo code COMMONS. This episode's also brought to you by the Fundamentals of Canadian Law podcast. It's a great way to learn the laws that apply to the stories we hear in the news or understand how the law affects our daily lives. It's a concise and conversational approach to the law, featuring legal experts from one of Canada's leading law faculties. And as someone who's written a lot about legal issues, I can tell you it is immeasurably helpful to have experts like these folks walk you through them. Take, for example, the recent kerfuffle over the Trans Mountain Pipeline. You know, initially it seemed that Kinder Morgan was going to be building it and they'd done consultations, but then the federal government bought the pipeline, but then a federal court brought it down. But now I'm hearing that it might still go through as long as they do some consultations. It's complicated stuff, and they really lay out the facts for you. Go on your favorite podcast app and search for Fundamentals in the search bar and subscribe to Fundamentals of Canadian Law.
See, the problem is a lot of what logically should be considered crimes or forbidden or illegal in the financial industry are completely legal.
The person I wanted to take on this tour is Bruce Livesey.
So my name is Bruce Livesey. I'm a journalist. I'm based here in Toronto. And I don't know, where does one begin?
He's a veteran investigative journalist who's worked for the CBC's Fifth Estate, Global News' 16 by 9, and has over the years written for almost every financial publication in the country. He's also the author of The Thieves of Bay Street, which gives you a pretty good idea what he's about.
We promptly got sued by Conrad Black, who sued us for $3 million. And then last year he withdrew the lawsuit, or as I like to say, you know, crawl back underneath his stone.
There There are so many places we could start this tour. We could take you to Commerce Court, which houses a building that actually used to be the tallest building in the British Empire for about 3 decades. And now it's home to CIBC. You probably remember Enron.
Millions of investors, both great and small, watched in disbelief as $70 billion in wealth vanished.
A number of banks were alleged to have aided and abetted Enron in their fraud, but it was humble CIBC that was found to be the most liable, and in 2005 they were forced to shell out $2.4 billion for their misdeeds. I could also tell you about the Adelaide Hotel, which used to be called the Trump Tower Toronto.
Secret payment of $100 million to be sent through various circuitous routes.
Financial Times, one of the world's most respected financial publications, has raised questions about whether a $100 million bribe flowed through the project to the Russian government, which they deny for the record. Or I could take you to a condo tower just around the corner from the Rogers Center, where Saadi Gaddafi, the son of former Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi, owned a penthouse.
The 41-year-old former head of Libya's football federation is best known for his fast living.
The RCMP has alleged that Canadian engineering firm SNC-Lavalin paid him millions of dollars in bribes to fund his lavish lifestyle that included a private concert by 50 Cent during TIFF. But I wanted to start with something you might not have heard of. It's one of my absolute favorite stories from Bruce's book. So we headed down to King and York Street, just a 15-minute walk from the Candleland offices, to the Toronto Stock Exchange. So let's describe the scene of the crime a little bit. The Toronto Stock Exchange, just like so many other buildings in any financial center, it's kind of ubiquitous. You got those big glass windows, it goes up high into the sky. And the only way you'd know that the stock exchange is even how I was there, is they have a little one of those tickers that you see at the bottom of the TV that just tell you the stock price pretty close to the sidewalk over there. I really want you to tell the story of YBM Magnets, a small magnet maker based out of Pennsylvania.
Well, the factory was based out of Hungary, but yeah, the head office was out of Pennsylvania.
In 1994, this magnet manufacturer put a listing up on the Alberta Stock Exchange. Within a few years, the stock had skyrocketed in value. And as their revenues grew, more people began to pile in. And they even ended up getting some big names on their board of directors, including a guy named David Peterson, who was the Liberal Premier of Ontario until 1990. By 1998, the company was worth around $1 billion. Unfortunately, it had just one small problem.
It was a front for a vicious Russian mobster, Mogilevich, how do you say it? Mogilevich.
Semyon Mogilevich is one of the world's most dangerous men. The boss of bosses of the Russian mafia, he's been known to brutally kill anyone who stands in his way. The FBI has said that with one phone call, Mogilevich has the ability to affect global markets. He may be the most powerful mobster in the world.
And was creating this empire in Eastern Europe. And at some point realized he needed to launder his money. And initially he tried to do it through the United Kingdom, and that didn't work. And then he decided that Canada was the best place to do it. And he got a foothold first in Alberta, and then eventually got a listing on the TSX.
So essentially, a small magnet maker makes it onto a stock exchange.
Which didn't actually make any magnets. It was a front, like a Potemkin Village factory in Budapest that wasn't actually making anything. But auditors and various investors and lawyers would go there and they would do a whole song and dance. They would show them this apparent factory, which was doing nothing. And managed to fool a lot of people.
But even with the song and dance, people had known about the connections between Mogilevich and YBM Magnex back to the company's founding. He was even registered as a shareholder. The board of directors, the TSX, they were all warned repeatedly that something was wrong.
But what was happening behind the scenes was that regulators were being told by the RCMP and the FBI that this was a dirty company.
The board hired investigators and set up a special committee to look into the allegations. Those investigators found there were red flags pointing to money laundering and connections to organized crime in Eastern Europe. But the special committee wrote it off as hearsay. And they didn't tell shareholders about the full extent of what the investigators had discovered.
The OSC listed them, the TSX listed them.
The OSC is the Ontario Securities Commission. We'll get to that later.
And it ended up attracting $100 million worth of investors' money. And within about 6 months, it was exposed and all that money was gone.
And by the time the truth had come out, Mogilevich had already sold his shares. In short, the board knew that the company had some ties to the Russian mafia, but they did not know for a fact that any criminal activity was taking place. And that includes Peterson. The OSC said that while they were disappointed in him, he did fulfill his legal duties.
Well, what was shocking, which came out in the investigation, because there was an investigation, there were hearings held, was how disinterested he was in the minutiae and details of the company. He simply wouldn't take notes. He barely attended meetings. Like, he was completely aloof and distant, even though the allegation was that this company might be a front for organized crime.
And so what happened to those directors? What happened to the OSC? I'm sure, once again, there must have been due fitting punishment.
Well, the problem was that the OSC themselves were being told they did nothing. So they were kind of, they couldn't exactly go and, you know, throw the book at the directors. You know, there was some penalties. There weren't, but they were fairly minor. No one went to prison. Mogilevich never set foot in prison. I mean, in the 20 years since that's happened, he's still alive and well and prospering.
And since then, David Peterson's had a fine career.
Yeah,
he was recently Chancellor of the University of Toronto.
There you go.
Very prestigious position.
Yes.
We reached out to Peterson for comment, but he didn't reply back by the time we published. Sophisticated criminals from abroad, like Mogilevich, see Canada as a target. They're looking for a place to put their money, and they're looking for a place that won't ask too many questions. And Canada's more than happy to take that money. When everything does come crashing down, almost nobody has to pay for the consequences. Now, to be fair to David Peterson, the whole Magnex scheme was pretty complicated. Involved smoke and mirrors and a fake Hungarian factory and securities and money laundering. You know, this was a sophisticated criminal operation. But it's not always like that. Some of the other crimes just have been very, very dumb. And the scene that I think illustrates that best happened at the former headquarters of one of Canada's most famous criminals.
So, I mean, let's get a look at this building over here. It's got the kind of old Greco-Roman style columns, which gives it the indication that this is a fancy, important building from back in the day.
Old Upper Canada Wells.
Exactly. And number 10 Toronto Street, I think what we're looking at over here is a black door with kind of fancy cursive writing on it that I think is supposed to give the impression that this is like 10 Downing Street.
Right.
The Prime Minister's residence in Britain.
So this used to be the head office of Conrad Black's very extensive operation.
Long story short, in the 90s, Conrad Black was running the third largest newspaper empire in the world. And that's at a time when newspapers were actually profitable. But by the 2000s, some of Hollinger's investors began to accuse Black and other executives of financial misconduct. In 2005, a report commissioned by Hollinger's board accused Black and another executive of, quote, lining their pockets at the expense of Hollinger almost every day in almost every way they could devise.
And that was the beginning of his demise. Because then, you know, then the American authorities began to investigate him, and they charged him with fraud. In the middle of all this, when there's an investigation against him, and there's a court order that comes down in Ontario saying he cannot touch any of his documents that are actually in this building.
Yep.
And literally the next day, on a, it's like a Friday, holiday Friday, he comes to this building with a vehicle, and he loads 13 boxes into his vehicle. And it's being videotaped. And at one point, he points to the video camera, so he knows he's being taped. Now, his claim was these are just personal effects. And we don't know. I mean, the boxes were eventually returned, but we don't know.
And so when Black was coming in on this holiday Friday to take out boxes that he couldn't, he wasn't supposed to take out due to a court order, was he just wearing like his normal getup? Did he at least have a
suit
mustache?
No, he had his suit on. He had his usual business attire on.
See, that's, I think, what his real downfall was. He should have dressed up, you know, maybe as the janitor or at least some kind of costume. Or gotten, you know, a lackey to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
This is, like you were saying, this is criminal 101.
That's smart.
Black was eventually convicted on a number of charges, some of which were overturned on appeal. But one fraud charge and an obstruction of justice charge related to moving those boxes stuck. We asked Black for comment on that report commissioned by the Hollinger Board, as well as the obstruction of justice charge, and this is what he sent us. Quote, please note that I collected the largest libel settlement in Canadian history, $5 million, in respect of that report. It pledged to produce record levels of profitability, and instead, within 2 years, the court-appointed stewards of the company, while grossly enriching themselves, had bankrupted the entire group, vaporizing $2 billion U.S. of shareholder value. That is my comment. Regards, Conrad Black. Black was never charged with any crime in Canada. And after he served a sentence in the U.S., he returned to this country, despite the fact that he gave up his citizenship years ago to take a British peerage.
He's still not a Canadian citizen, but he's allowed to live here as a convicted felon. Like, where else would that happen? If you were a person of color who used to be a Canadian citizen, went to jail in the United States, you were poor, black, you think you'd be allowed back into this country and allowed to live here as a convicted felon? No.
All right. After a brisk little walk, we're now just across from Old City Hall, right next to the Eaton Center.
This building is home to both the Ontario Securities Commission, as well as the RCMP's IMET, which is short for the Integrated Markets Enforcement Team. They're a white-collar crime unit dedicated to taking down exactly the type of stuff we're talking about today. But unfortunately, they're not exactly great at their job.
We have a terrible track record. On the policing side, the regulatory policing side of white-collar crime are arguably the worst country in the developed world.
A recent Globe and Mail investigation found that even though the RCMP's IMET team was allocated more than $19 million for potential prosecutions between 2005 and 2017, they spent just $500,000 of that money. And when it comes to the regulators, Canada is arguably in an even worse position. We're only one of two developed countries that doesn't have a national securities regulator. The other country? Bosnia and Herzegovina. Instead, every province and territory has its own securities regulator.
Which is insane, because what that means is that here in Toronto, the Ontario Securities Commission is captured by the local financial industry and the legal establishment, the big law, you know, the so-called seven sister law firms. And they don't want a national securities regulator because having a local provincial securities regulator means that it can be run by your friends who all live in Forest Hill or in Rosedale, and they don't want to put their friends in jail. So if you're a Department of Justice lawyer in Washington, you don't give a shit about the guys in Houston running the scam of Enron. You'll put their asses in jail. You'll get a great job at a big law firm if you do that. In Canada, it's the opposite. If you're not an aggressive Ontario Securities Commission lawyer and you go after one of the big rich people in Canada, you're not going to get a job with the big seven sister law firms because they don't want a lawyer who's caused pain to one of their clients. So that is the political dynamic of Canada, because it's a decentralized regulatory system. It allows white-collar crime to flourish because the local securities commissions, they don't want to put their friends in jail.
And why don't our politicians do anything about it? Why not change the laws or invest more resources into policing and enforcement?
I think the second part of it is white-collar crime is not a big issue in this country. It's a big issue. It happens a lot. A lot of money is lost. But politically, it's not a big issue. So they spend hundreds of millions of dollars, even in excess, I would say, probably of at least $1 billion a year in this country, various police forces chasing after Islamic terrorism. But they spend no money, almost no money, on white-collar crime, even though most Canadians are never going to be affected by Islamic terrorism. Never. I mean, the chances of being killed by an Islamic terrorist in this country are so unbelievably remote. But your chance of your money being stolen are extremely high. There was a study done years ago that said 1 million Canadians had been victims of white-collar fraud. Yet they spend almost no money investigating white-collar crime. So it's a very political decision. And it's because they don't want to go after the rich. It's not that complicated. They don't want to go after the rich.
And that's the end of our crime tour. We've told you a lot of stories about people and companies in Canada that were never prosecuted for any of their alleged misconduct. But even when people are caught, even the most blatant stock market swindlers, only 10% of them ever face jail time. And the money they steal, almost none of it's ever paid back. For the rest of this season of Commons, we're going to be bringing you more stories about frauds, swindles, and hustles from across the country, and about the governments that enable them, look the other way, or even have their own hands in the till. On the next episode of Commons...
It's not donuts or a few groceries in those plastic bags. It's cash. Hundreds of thousands of dollars. Casually dumped onto the counter at a BC casino.
We're taking you to beautiful British Columbia. That's your episode of Commons for the week. I'm Arshi Mann. If you're a corrupt politician, business person, or son of a dictator, please get in touch and we may feature you on the show. If not, we'd still love to hear what you think. Tweet us at Canadaland Commons, that's CMNS. You can also email me at arshi@canadalandshow.com. This episode was produced by Kevin Sexton. Our music is by Nathan Burley, and we'll be back every second Tuesday. But if you're interested in listening to the nitty-gritty of what's going on in Parliament Hill, check out our other politics podcast, Oppo, that you can find next Tuesday. If you like what we do, please support us at patreon.com/canadaland.
That's a man's job.
Wow.
Did this dude just tell a sexist joke?
That's so awkward.
That other guy noticed. He's also uncomfortable. I'm sick of guys trying to show off by putting women down. Bro, honestly, that's not even funny.
You're right, man. My bad. It's time to draw the line. Step up, speak up, and be an ally. Challenge sexism and sexual violence. Visit dtl.whiteribbon.ca. A message brought to you by White Ribbon. Do you want-
today. It is the 21st of September. That was DOA with War. You're listening on 102.7 CKMS, RadioWaterloo.ca, Rogers Cable 946 as well. AWOL Radio is streaming on Dan Keller's YouTube channel. Host Dan Keller in studio with you today. We're going to read a couple things. First up, we're going to north-shore.info. London Call to Action Against Pegida on October 13th. This one was submitted anonymously to North Shore Counter Info, north-shore.info. Over the long weekend on October 13th, London's far-right group known as Pegida will be returning once again to their protected space in front of City Hall. Recent appearances in Toronto have had them supported by various right-wing groups, but in London they often show up in low numbers. The last couple times, however, we are beginning to notice that they are being flanked by groups like Soldiers of Odin, Proud Boys, and occasionally other groups. I am an individual who has seen my fair share of rallies and will not be able to attend for a variety of legitimate reasons, and I am sending this in hopes that a call for help will be answered by comrades and allies in the region. London has historically been known as a white power hub, but that has all changed in recent years. The white power boneheads are all but extinct or have moved on to more mundane activity unrelated to politics. Of course, we know that our big threat now comes from these new groups who don't wave swastika flags and brawl at punk shows. These far-right groups are tenacious, showing up repeatedly despite the overwhelming opposition and multitudes of failures, all while not having a cohesive leader to bring their movement out of obscurity. It is in this that London becomes a very dangerous breeding ground for new extremism, as our city's new immigrant population has to adjust to what amounts to a very white-collar conservative town with a new student population every year that could bring in just about anybody. Our opposition to this needs to be multifaceted and willing to be ready for any situation. We know that these groups don't represent London, they don't represent the working class they claim to speak for, and they don't represent what we want to see take root here again without roving gangs of white supremacists. Never again means never again. Pegida, as we all know, is a branch of the broader European movement which directly connects itself to white supremacist groups and neo-Nazis. Unsurprisingly, they don't stray far from the path here, and you can see their efforts in more detail on Anti-Racist Canada blog. There's an analysis of rhetoric and recent actions in London, another article, and again that's on anti-racist.blogspot.com. London's efforts are primarily run by a single woman with too much time on her hands, and her followers directly are lowly baby boomers with radical Christian ideology. It really isn't Pegida that concerns me, it's the optics and prestige that these other far-right militant groups get when they use it as an opportunity to attack anti-fascists in a setting that isn't Toronto. Pegida has succeeded in annoying London residents to this extent, and as such, you never know what to expect at their rallies. Sometimes it is a minimal police presence with minimal turnout and no incidents. They sometimes do surprise demos with no one watching. Not sure what they think they're getting from this. Other times, fists and massive counter-demos, such as last August, have been the case for them. I can share with you my experience and suggestions for anyone coming to counter them that isn't familiar with London and their efforts here. First, something I noticed was that occasionally a young kid shows up to the counter demo masked up but alone. This might possibly be opinion, but I don't think this is wise as an individual, as it makes you stick out like a sore thumb and draws immediate press attention to the desperate reporters who are on the scene. This is entirely your choice, but if you plan on coming alone, cover up in a way that doesn't appear out of place and don't wear your punk jacket with giveaway patches. Try to stay close with a group and just take time to meet some people. Second, Pegida appears on city steps in front of the main door, sometimes earlier, to allow for a wall of police to protect them and create a secure space for them to run from if they need to, probably down Centennial Lane, a side street alley, or the parking garage where I assume they may park their vehicles. The counter usually happens opposite to that, but as the last August rally showed, it was so big that some people got mixed up in the wrong group, which could have took a serious turn for the worse. Police are, of course, not on our side, and they are supported by private security, which guards City Hall, so plainclothes will be a possibility, especially on the flanks.
If you need to escape for any reason, know that the area you will be in is pretty open and you won't have a close alley to duck into, so please plan your routes accordingly. Pegida's militant wings have varying degrees of tactics and pseudo-military strategy, but assumed all are armed with any or all of pepper spray, knives, flagpoles, tasers, etc. If Pegida marches, their militants will try to get ahead of the police to instigate confrontation, and groups like 3%ers have attacked unprovoked before. They usually try to march to Richmond Street, which is a block away, and can also potentially march through Victoria Park, which is right next to City Hall. Another thing I would like to mention is that the London activist networks have been in disarray for the past some years due to burnout, suspect individuals, and a stalled movement to build solidarity with other regional groups. On top of this, Pegida pressing charges against some anti-fascists is reducing the number of counter-protesters who can show up prepared or willing to stand in between those who choose not to engage in self-defense. We always outnumber them, of course, but we can always use more. And we need more people ready to stand up to the more militant groups like Soldiers of Odin, Proud Boys, 3%ers, who all are out to make a name for themselves through violence. I don't believe that some of our locals understand that a physical threat has had multiple opportunities to appear, and only by sheer luck have we avoided anything serious. By having other people attend, we will be able to forge stronger connections with each other and be prepared to combat the insurgent far right, which is ramping up its violent rhetoric and getting down to the wire in terms of membership commitment. I hope this can get some groups thinking about this and get a turnout similar to what we had last August, which understandably was right after Charlottesville. This won't be the last time Pegida shows up here, unfortunately, and I hope that this is another failure for them. And again, that was from north-shore.info, London, call to action against Pegida on October 13th. Show up, shut them down. There is another piece from North Shore, north-shore.info. I'm not going to read it as it is a long written interview, and it's regarding Lindsay Shepherd, who is trying to put on an event or is being hosted at Queen's University later this month. So check that out on north-shore.info as well regarding Lindsay Shepherd. And sticking with the far right, a visual guide released by Montreal-antifasciste.info. And this is the far right, a visual guide available in French and English, downloadable PDF or as a JPEG, an image file. And it goes over all of the different fascist symbols that you might come across. Not all of them, but in Canada it shows, you know, neo-Nazi, neo-fascist, and identitarian symbols, like Atlante Quebec, Quebec Stompers, the Hammerskins, Blood and Honor, Soldiers of Odin Quebec, Canadian National Front, goes on. Far-right groups, Islamophobic, anti-immigration groups, Pegida's in there. WKAI is in there, of course. All these groups have been putting on, trying to put on demos in Toronto for the last several years, always opposed by large resistance, which also needs to be bigger every time. The way to win this without the violence that people don't seem to want is numbers. 10, 20, 30 times the amount of people, thousands of people to their dozens. That will keep them off the streets. And, political parties are listed in this. The, you know, like the New Constitution Party of Canada, the Faith for Mayor, the Nationalist Party of Canada, a bunch of ones in Quebec, Parti Indépendiste, Parti de Unité Nationale, Union Patriote, a bunch of media groups. We see we just had Your Ward News, Ontario Proud, Freebird Media, of course, Rebel Media, militias like the 3%ers, anti-feminist groups, religious groups, and hate symbols that you see. We see these in Kitchener, Waterloo quite often, symbols that get put up that need to be taken down one way or the other as quick as possible. Don't let your communities be overrun with hate symbols, and know your hate symbols. Know what they are. Things like the thin blue line, things like the which is pro-cop, Blue Lives Matter, but it's like through Canadian flags, through warrior shields, things like that. And obviously, like swastikas and Iron Crosses, a lot of Norse symbolism here, a little Celt as well, that is appropriated for these white supremacist, Nazi, fascist movements, whatever you want to call them. So again, good night, white pride, as in you're going to get stomped and be passed out from being stomped. Montreal-antifasciste.info for that, the far-right visual guide. Well, I guess that's all. We're going to go to a song, and then we're going to go to an interview. The interview is No Borders Media feature interview with members of the Rose City Antifa. But first, let's go to a tune here on AWOL Radio, on Radio Waterloo. It's KMS.
Let us stand echo of faraway voices boarding faraway trains to take them home to the ones that they love and who love them forever. The place that you steps, repeat my own and reflect my thoughts. Curling and in white jeans, partially naked except for taffy wrappers and this morning's paper. Mr. John's got run down, head of some death, and so later of tomorrow, my man on the rampage. And I'm down in the tube station at midnight. Oh. I fumble for change and pull out the queen, smiling. Darling, I put in the money and pull out a plum behind me. Whispers in the shadow, cross-placing voices, hating, waiting. Hey, brother, shout, have you got any money? And I sell a little money and I take away curry. I'm on the way home to my wife. She'll be lying at the country, you know she's expecting me. Polishing the glasses out, pulling out the cold. I'm down in the tube station at midnight. Oh, oh, oh. I first felt a fist and then a kick. I could now smell that breath. They smell of pubs and warmer scrubs and too many right-wing meetings. My life swam around me, it took a look at drowning sounding systems. The smell of brown leather blended in with the weather. Essence filled my eyes, ears, nose and body block. All my senses couldn't see it, ears speak any longer. And I'm down in the tube station at midnight. The tube station at midnight. Oh, 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 oh. And the last thing I saw as I lay on the floor was in Jesus' saves play. Was a matterist that you end up with this way. Was a real hell on the way die. A cheap holiday. Tonight I bounce back to my life with all of my mind. But if they took the keys out, she'll think it's me. I'm down in the tube station at midnight. The wine will be flat down the curry stone tune. Down in the tube station at midnight. Oh, 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 oh. Don't want to go down in the tube station at midnight. Oh, 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 oh. Don't want to go down in the tube station at midnight.
Down in the tube station at midnight. Dawson, joined by Jesse Zubot and a string quartet with Lucky Hand. Do stick around. We've got more great Celtic. You're listening to Celt in a Twist, and I'm Patricia Fraser.
An island of tranquility to soothe your soul and ease your troubled mind. Celt in a Twist presents A Pearl of Wisdom and a Pause for Reflection.
Relax, smell your roses, and then you'll be ready for a good probing.
This is your Cosmic Celtic Play of the Day.
Our Cosmic Celtic play for today is Way Over Yonder in the Minor Key by Hannah Sanders and Ben Savage. But first, this thought to ponder from Oliver Wendell Holmes, Sr. Little I ask, my wants are few. I only ask a hut of stone, a very plain brown stone will do, that I may call my own. And close at hand is such a one in yonder street that fronts the sun.
Come from a place called Ofosky. Sing like me, ain't nobody that could sing like me. She said it's hard for me to see how one little boy got so ugly. Said, darling, that might be. Well, there ain't nobody that could sing like me, ain't nobody that could sing like me. Way over yonder in the minor key. Way over yonder in the minor key. There ain't nobody that can sing like me. We went down to the Buckeye Creek. See the frog in the coca. Hear the whistling coming from the east. But there ain't nobody that can sing like me. Ain't nobody that can sing like me. Mama got a switch from a cherry tree. Laid it on the she and me. Sing like me, ain't nobody that can sing like me. Way over yonder in the minor key. Way over yonder in the minor key. There ain't nobody that can sing like me.
Yonder in the minor key. Yonder in the minor.
gentleman who is just in town, Tony McManus and The Devil in the Kitchen. Thanks so much for joining us today on Celt in a Twist. We are produced and recorded through the facilities of Calcopirate Communications. Our producer is Cal Coat. We are going to go out on Great Big Sea and oh yeah. Till next time, I'm Patricia Fraser.
I've got spots on my cock, I've got bumps on my junk. They say that it's a virus, it's called molluscum. I treat it with tea tree, I take lots of showers. It's the cleanest I've ever been, I wash my hands 10 times an hour. I go to the doctor every other week, she sprays it with nitrogen. And when she's done, she spreads this gunk, it's called protophyllin. The spots are molluscum contagiosum, it means don't touch my cock at least for 3 months while I've got these spots. But we can still be sexy if you want to still be sexy. I don't need to use my cock, I can show you if you want me. I've got mouth and I've got hands, your wish is my command. When it comes to your body, well, you know that I'm a fan. Don't let these spots on my cock, these bumps on my junk, get in the way of us being safe and having fun. We'll be right back.
that's hard to refuse. After all the flowery words, there's extra power in a mild profanity. Don't you see? I'll be in the back of the theater drinking and laughing.
Over mortal men I tower, fearless, full of power, but slave, slave to my maker. Created by dark undertakings, I am their wondrous atom. Yet I'd like to damn them to the same empty hell where I am. We'll be right back.
artificial man. It's hollow in my chest. Something witty was. Heaviness now gone. Where once sorrow touched me. Visited once by joy, though now there is none. An artificial man. Their artificial man.
Thank you.
Yeah. just about everyone, and I hide in my baby's arms, hide in my baby's arms, 'cause except for her, you know, is I've implied.
Non-stop.
To every argument I let slide. Christ.